So in the time that we now have, I want to focus very much on the fruits of contemplation, remembering that contemplation is itself an action. And the fruits of contemplation are, of course, mindful action, chosen action, action done with goodwill, or actions with goodwill that somehow restore ourselves to ourselves when we have acted unwisely. In other words, and I hope I've said this often enough, we need not be too afraid of acting unwisely because we can learn from it and move on. It need not shame us. We may feel shame quite appropriately, but we do not have to dwell in that place. You see the difference, don't you? Sometimes we should be ashamed. Yep. But we need not be shamed in a kind of brutalizing or permanent way. So I'm going to do my very best with these questions and answers in relation to action. But I'm also going to remind you that nobody knows more about your life than you do. I know much less about your life than you do. And I especially know much less than your inner teacher. So here are two wonderful reminders, which are only 2,500 years ago, so pretty recent in the scheme of things. The first is from the historical Buddha. Believe nothing because a wise person has said it. Believe nothing because it is generally held. Believe nothing because it is written. Believe nothing because it is said to be divine. Believe nothing because someone else believes it. But believe only what you yourself know, discover through your experimenting and through your perceptions. Only what you know through your perceptions and your observing of the effect of your actions, for example, to be true. And from almost the same moment, 500 years BC, as it's called here, from the Pirkei Avot, which is a book of Jewish teachings, that's so wonderful. No matter how famous the mouth, check the word against experience. Oh, I so love that. We are here to do. And through learning to know, and through knowing to wonder, and through wonder to attain simplicity, and through simplicity to give attention, and through attention to see what needs to be done. Pirkei, P-I-R-K-E, Avot, A-V-O-T. It's a collection of Jewish teachings. Pirkei Avot. Isn't it good? No matter how famous the mouth, check the word against experience. It means the most humble of us may have a wisdom that is beyond description, and the most learned of us may be quite blocked. Especially if we are too impressed by what we already know and are not open to knowing quite a bit more. All right. So thank you very much for these questions, which are very thoughtful, and I'll get through as many of them as I can. The first one is, are some people naturally much kinder than others? I think kindness is a potential in all of us, but it is also a talent. And I think perhaps some people come in with a bit more of a talent than others. If you don't feel you have a natural talent for kindness, then it is an even better teacher for you. If you learn it too easily, you might not learn it as thoroughly. Let kindness itself be your teacher. Observe the effects of your kindness on others. And in everyday kindness, there are countless examples of how many faces kindness has. Respect, listening, patience, perseverance, dignity, thoughtfulness, concern, doing ordinary tasks with some grace, offering what you yourself wish to receive. So many examples. If learning kindness is a challenge for you also, check something else. Does this person deserve my kindness? And does that person not deserve my kindness? Because we learn nothing about kindness until we do it because we can. We don't think first who deserves it, our grace and favor. But we can. It is an expression of our consideration for ourselves and our human family and our environment. So how also will we be kind to the earth? The younger of my grandchildren is a boisterous little boy, but I think he has a real talent for kindness, and I'll just give you two very small examples. He's 2.5. He'll be three actually in December, and he hasn't come from the easiest of situations because his parents are already living separately. So it's not just that he's been in the Garden of Eden all of this time. I want to say that because we often think that things are easier for people when everything has gone well. He is very loved, though. He's very loved. Very loved. And my daughter was at a school assembly for her older child, Madeline, who's 6. And she had Charlie with her. And Charlie has a whole series of what he calls snuggles, which have a little sheepy head and then a sort of sheepy bit around. And he doesn't mind which snuggle it is, but he loves his snuggles. Mm-hmm. They're interchangeable, actually. They're interchangeable transitional objects, as Winnicott would have called them. Self-soothing. And they were sitting, and just next to them was quite a bit older boy, maybe 8 or so, sitting with his mum or with a woman carer. And Charlie noticed, this was months and months ago when he was just 2 and didn't have lots of language, noticed that the little boy's knee was bleeding. So he took his snuggle out of Keziah's handbag and put it on the other knee. I thought that was a very natural gesture and a very beautiful gesture. Of course, the big challenge will be for all the Charlies in our world, all the little boys of tender-heartedness, that they may grow in increasing tender-heartedness and that models of masculinity don't take it from them. The other was a more recent example, which is that I had quite a bad and most unexpected fall recently, which was very jarring, and other than Paul, who was with me at the time, was in Sydney at the time, because Paul still lives in the Northern Territory where he does his wonderful work. And so he was exceptionally kind to me. But the other person who asked me so many questions about how I was and how it had happened and why and why and why and why and so tenderly interested, and did I need more Band-Aids and did I need more doctor, not just Paul, and so on. Yes, was this little child. Can I protect my thinking and my thought processes so that they are healing me, so that they are healing me and not hurting others in any way? Yes, you can. You can use your contemplative practices, not just to protect your thinking, but to liberate your thinking of goodwill. Your contemplative practices of meditation, prayer, singing, observing, noticing, receiving, taking in, delighting in, all softening. They will inevitably heal you. They will inevitably heal you. And when you notice that you have hurt others, they will also give you the courage to acknowledge that, not to pretend it hasn't happened, to acknowledge it, to say how sorry you are and that it need not happen again. So this is quite a long one. I'll make it a little bit shorter. The person says, I feel I've lived in a world that increasingly conditions us to value things like wealth, power, status, and material goods as the path to wellness and happiness. Well, every writer, every teacher, every thinker, every seeker, every participant in life understands that once we have wealth, power, status, and material goods, once we know where clean water comes from, then we are very quickly also taught by life itself that this is not the entire solution to all of our suffering. We are very fortunate if we are in that position that we can see that our material well-being, because for the millions who are struggling for material well-being, we could possibly think, they would imagine that if they could turn a tap on and have clean water for their children, if they had the luxury of bathing their children, if they had the luxury of giving their children medicines when the children are ill, how could they be anything but happy in every single moment? The complexity of our lives requires more of us. The complexity of our lives requires that we acknowledge with immense gratitude the unfairness of the world from which we benefit. We benefit from the injustices of this world. We benefit from the fact that people are working for $5 a week in factories. We benefit from the fact that people are growing food or growing tobacco where they could be growing food. Yeah? As a society, we benefit from that. Okay, so what do we then owe our human family in terms of understanding happiness? So what I believe, but believe nothing just because I've said it, what I believe we owe life is to summon up our resources, to be resourceful, to be sustaining of goodwill in all its countless material, spiritual, and emotional facets. Yeah? So in our immediate world, how are we bringing greater happiness and peace to others? In our wider world, How are we protecting the physical environment? In our global world, how are we speaking up when that is needed? Giving money when that is needed, giving our intellectual property freely when that is needed. Our understanding is what I mean by intellectual property. I don't mean it's something that we should be, having a lawyer give us a, you know, what's it called when you... Yeah, not patenting it, because it doesn't belong to us, doesn't it? It doesn't. So choosing happiness was very much about this. Seeking the sacred is absolutely about this. Seeking the sacred is my peacemaking testimony. It is absolutely about this. At the same time, every day I have lessons about my immediate environment, including the immediate environment of my mind and heart. It is an extraordinarily fortunate thing that the human brain has the capacity for this very subtle and for the large. I don't mean for the gross, I mean for the vast. We can move from the vast to the subtle with a thought. So we also owe it to our human family to develop our minds and to keep our minds as well as possible. I think we owe it to participate in the to participate as our gifts and talents bring us to, but also to drink of the living waters of knowledge. Not knowledge in information, knowledge of who we are and who the other is. Could you talk about the tension between being there already, being already there, and the desire or opportunity to be more loving along this path? It's a paradox. They coexist, and that's the wonder of it. We are already there, and we are unfolding. What are we unfolding? We are unfolding what is already there. We are getting to know it. Yeah? You're getting to know your immortal nature. You're getting to know your original nature. You're getting to know your soul. You're getting to know your inner teacher. And you are becoming, through and in that, more grounded within yourself. And it's a journey that has its mountains and has its valleys, has its peaks and has its plateaus, and has its times of great discomfort, and has its times of unexpected comforting. How do I know if an action is worth pursuing? You could all answer that. What is it bringing with it? What is the action bringing with it? What is the action bringing with it? Is it bringing greater harmony and greater understanding and greater well-being between myself and others? Or is it not? There are also some actions that take more care of us than of the others. And sometimes that also has to happen. And then high levels of compassion and not blaming and self-responsibility are called for. Yep. And I would also say to be very careful, always, all of us, around the ego defense of self-righteousness. To be very careful around the ego defense of self-righteousness. It's self-righteousness. Well, we see it on the public stage, where people, for example, feel utterly entitled. Now, in the United States, it's going on again around abortion, the protection of unborn life, while at the same time there's this mad worship of guns and mad worship of war, violence, killing, and yet somehow the unborn have a greater right to life than the born. And there's a lot of self-righteousness with it. There's a lot of self-righteousness also in Australia at the moment around the right of certain people who unfortunately call themselves Christian to decide on other people's right to marry, even more than that, on their right to be adequately loving. And people are donating in the millions for this. So it's easy to see where self-righteousness is on the outer plane, isn't it? Especially if we disagree with that particular platform of self-righteousness. It's a little bit harder sometimes to perceive our own self-righteousness and where it's getting in the way. You talk about the inner teacher, and I like that idea, but how do I know it's not just my ego or anxieties or desires and drives telling me what I should do? I have answered this a couple of ways. The inner teacher will never tell you to do what is harmful. The inner teacher will protect you, remove you from harm, but also remove you from unnecessary harming of others. So, for example, there might be somebody in your life that you need to see less of because that person is very agitating for you or leaves you feeling very unloved in a real way. Now, your inner teacher may not necessarily guide you about seeing much less of that person or seeing that person always in the company of another. But in order to do this action, you don't need to send that other person to hell in your mind. You don't need to rehearse all the things that are wrong with them. You simply need to attend to your self-healing, which may mean not seeing them at all. There's no recipe for this. Be guided by the inner teacher. Certainly, where there is a situation of abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, then a great deal of separation is needed, in my view, and very often for all time. But then we also need to pay attention to how we continue to connect through the mind. Because when there has been a very problematic situation, we will continue to connect through the mind. And often, it is very helpful, even if you have no beliefs that are sort of outrageously spiritual or religious. To turn it over to the universe, to turn it over to God, to turn it over to the forces of love. In other words, for it as much as possible to cease to be my personal connection, praying for the soul of that person, not worrying too much about forgiveness, not forgiveness, not necessarily going there, paying attention to my self-healing. And also, and I say this with great passion because I don't know all your stories, and also getting the help you need. There is skillful help available. There's also unskillful help available. Find skillful help if you need it. How would you know the difference? One will lift your spirits and the other won't. Yeah? What happens in a life that is dry and without joy? There is lots of fire, but it's not warming. What is there to hope for? This is a profound question, and the person who wrote it, I'm going to leave it on the table because I want you, when you go home, I don't know who this person is, to make a little altar. You could all make a little altar and sometimes just put your question on it. And gradually, inspiration will come to you. A life that is dry certainly needs the watering of loving emotion. There's a prayer that I put in Heaven on Earth that I wrote myself. I wrote quite a few of those prayers, partly because one of my publishers asked me to do that and really gave me the courage to do it. And it starts, "Sweet Holy Spirit, today I am dry." And it's a very short prayer because on the day you're dry, you don't have very much. And it ends with something like, "In the stillness, give me your stillness, which is the peace beyond all understanding." So there's lots of fire. I find that very hopeful. So the final sentence was, "What is there to hope for?" The dryness is also receptive. When water comes, the dryness itself transforms. So I would be in this person's life at this moment, and this is all our lives at some moment. This is all of our lives at some moment. I would be particularly curious about what feels watering. And I would be particularly hopeful that what the lots of fire tells me I have passion, but it needs a context. What is the context that supports my passion? And this is where creativity comes in. Not about doing, but about receiving. For example, when you have heard the music that we've played, or when you've heard the music of the poetry, or when you've sat with others in the stillness, has that refreshed you? Do more of it. So this one I'll put here, and please take it and put it on your altar at home. And let the universe provide. Please explain the difference between spirit and soul, or are they intertwined? Well, everything is intertwined. I've no idea, really. Spirit, soul, immortal being, Buddha nature. The essence of love, the traces of thought and action. It's all guidance. I want others to benefit from your life messages as I have. I have two nieces in their mid-30s. One suffers from depression, lack of self-worth. All our nieces suffer from some lack of self-worth. All our nephews suffer from some lack of self-worth. All our aunties, all our uncles, all our brothers, all our sisters, all our mothers, all our fathers. All ourselves. Self-worth is a huge challenge in our hasty, competitive society. What do we value most? What do we value most? Even in ourselves and each other. The other one has anorexia. I'll really pray for all our nieces, all our nephews, all our aunties, all our uncles, all our mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters. Is there a book of yours that springs to mind that I could purchase for them? It's a very loving question. For the niece who is anorexic, I would really hope there's still a copy of Choosing Happiness. It comes in small sections. And if there isn't a copy left, please order one through your bookshop. It's easily ordered. And while you're about it, order a couple of copies through your local library so that it's there when somebody's eye falls upon it and needs it. The thing about Choosing Happiness is that the small sections are sometimes all we can take in. And when we're starving ourselves at the physical level, we're often starving ourselves. Yes, and when we're sometimes having an overabundance, we're also sometimes starving ourselves of what we need. So the small sections of Choosing Happiness, I think, would be very helpful. What will also be helpful is not something that is read, but something that is given. So I would, unfortunately, I have a whole double CD on self-love, but I have no way of bringing it to you because it's not manufactured any longer and it's not on iTunes. That's another manufacturing problem that lives with me, but peaceful mind also brings sweetness and affirmation of worth. The Universal Heart is a very helpful book, but I think more for the person who wrote this question than for the nieces, for the darling nieces. What is the meaning of neutrality in one's relationship with another? When might it be helpful or appropriate to seek to be neutral? Excuse me. In the context of an ongoing familial relationship with another person. I'm not sure that neutrality is quite the word here. Neutral is a deceptive word because none of us is genuinely neutral. None of us is genuinely neutral. Switzerland is a very good example of this. Switzerland calls itself a neutral country and takes great pride in it. At the same time, its wealth has depended upon stolen goods, confiscated goods, goods confiscated from the despised, goods confiscated through robbing others of their dignity and well-being. It's also a complex country, inasmuch as it gave women the vote about 5 minutes ago. And it's also a very arrogant country, inasmuch as it has had Gastarbeiten, guest workers, for a very long time and denied them citizenship. Of course, Buddhist Burma has also denied citizenship to people over many generations, including the Rohingya people. So none of our faults are specific, but I'm just saying that because neutrality is a bit of a fake, a false self, a false national self, a false self, neutrality. However, there's a really wonderful spiritual teaching from our Buddhist brothers and sisters. May they awaken to this grace in Myanmar. And that is detachment from outcome. Bringing the very best of ourselves to a situation, but detaching ourselves at least somewhat that it has to go this way or that. This requires quite a lot of practice and skill. So please keep at it, because usually we are very attached to outcome, aren't we? What's more, we want the outcome to be ours. Because after all, who knows better than me? Yeah? So we want the outcome to be the desire that's arisen in our conditioned mind, rather than the desire that has arisen in someone else's conditioned mind. If we step beyond our two conditioned minds and think instead of bringing greater harmony and well-being to the situation, then we may be more accepting of outcome and more willing to participate in a curious and open-minded and good-willing way. I think that's a lot to think about. I'm going to say Om Shanti.